This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize. Good morning, good afternoon for folks that are just joining us. We'll get things started here in just a moment as I see both humans and a few meeting bots entering the room, taking notes for those unable to join. It's good to have you here. We're going to kick things off in just a moment. But I'm just glad to have us all back together here in the new year. So many things for us to cover and talk about. Remember, if you're new to joining us with TGIF DTRA and you're joining us here live, the topics that we cover come from you, the folks in this community. So if there are topics you'd like to see us cover, maybe you're putting out a paper or a white paper, maybe you have some data you're presenting at a conference, we love having authors come join us. It's a great opportunity to continue to share the important work you've done and have an opportunity for folks in the community to come hear from you and get to ask you questions. But with that, Amir, Jane, I think we have a quorum. So unless there's a staunch disagreement, I'd say we jump right in.
Fantastic.
Great. Hello and welcome to those of you joining us here online live, as well as to those that are enjoying this as your favorite podcast at a later date. You've landed with us here in TGIF DTRA. Remember, we do gather here most weeks, not every week, is sometimes there's just too many other conferences and plane tickets that get in the way. But when we do gather, we're gathering to discuss the topics that are important to you, the folks in this community. So if you do have work, research, publications, topics that are important to you that you'd like to see us share, just reach out to Jane Miles, myself, Amir Kalali. You can reach us through LinkedIn or your favorite other social channel. Let us know what topics you'd love to see. If you're shy about using LinkedIn, you could just drop an email to secretariat@dtra.org. We love having guests, especially who are doing some innovative work or sharing some new data and research. And so if that's you and you have maybe a publication, a presentation coming up, let us know, and we'd love to be able to pick that topic up together. This week, I'm really excited because we have some friends and colleagues from the FDA joining us on the topic of selective safety data collection, SSDC. What is SSDC? What are some of the fears maybe in industry or misconceptions or myth-busting that we can do around SSDC? And where does it fit? Where does it actually make sense? And where doesn't it, you know, in terms of the do's or don'ts? But perhaps most importantly for many in this community, how do you engage? Where can you get started? And where is the entry door, say, with the FDA for those in industry that are curious about incorporating selective safety data collection in an upcoming program? Fortunately, we have three fabulous guests today to help us demystify all of those topics. That includes Magana Chelasani from CDER's Center for Therapeutic Innovation, C3TI. We have Dr. Mary Tanhai, who is the director for the Office of New Drugs at CDER. And we have Dr. Mitch Sotka, who is also in CDER, a medical officer in the Division of Cardiology and Nephrology. And so, Jane, I think we have some fabulous voices to help us demystify here. Anything I missed before we just jump right in? I'm getting the okie dokie, so that's the sign to let's go. So let's jump right in then. And Mary, I think you're a great voice to help us get started. For folks that aren't familiar with this idea of selective safety data collection, this isn't really a new idea. I noticed from your white paper that there was FDA guidance going back to 2016, and something tells me if there was guidance in 2016, the topic was percolating for even years before then. How would you describe SSDC, selective safety data collection, for folks that may not be familiar with the topic?
So thanks so much for the question, Craig. So SSDC or selective safety data collection, often we just say SSDC. I just want to start off by saying that sometimes you may hear me say E19 or others say E19, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But really, in a nutshell, SSDC really is about a planned approach in how we can collect safety or certain types of data in a clinical trial that is really intended to be collecting what is necessary information. It's a planned reduction in the collection of certain types of data when you have a drug that has a very well-characterized safety profile. It's felt that we're in those situations where if you continue to collect all data, well, often we call it a comprehensive safety data collection, that it may actually not provide that much more information of clinical importance. And so the intent here is that when you apply SSDC in a clinical investigation is that you are streamlining and making drug development more efficient. You are actually collecting what matters for the objectives of that clinical trial. You'd mentioned that this was discussed in the guidance in 2016. You're absolutely right. It's not a novel idea. It had been actually even evident before 2016, before the guidance came out, the FDA guidance came out. And we realized that as we were actually developing the E19 guidance, which was part of a collaborative effort with international partners, that there are actually quite a few publications where people were already applying this concept. It's just that we didn't actually have a name attached to it. The intent here is perhaps to get people to understand that it's really a powerful tool to apply appropriately to improve efficiencies in drug development to get safe and effective therapies to the market faster.
And Mary, you mentioned E19. Was that the FDA kind of appreciating that sponsors may be reticent to use an SSDC approach for multinational trials when there was only, say, clarity of that pathway with FDA? Was that kind of a drive from this team to try to make that more of a global norm so that sponsors for multicenter research could adopt globally?
Yeah, absolutely. When the guidance came out, the FDA guidance came out in 2016, and unfortunately, I can't remember the exact title of that guidance. I don't remember if it actually had selective safety data collection in there. But I remember having discussions with companies, particularly one embarking on these large cardiovascular outcomes trial, which Mitch can certainly attest to in his background. The companies are saying these are really difficult trials to conduct and they're very expensive and we're collecting so much information. And one of the things that we brought to their attention is like, well, you know about this guidance. These are programs where you have a very targeted objective. And these are trials that are being done typically in a post-approval setting. So we know a lot about the drugs already. Why are you not applying this guidance recommendation? And the response is, drug development is global. And while it is something that is put out by FDA, which, actually, even at FDA, there was a lot of communication that needed to be brought out to staff and FDA to make sure that they recognize that this is something that can be applied even outside of the cardiovascular space. But they said that because drug development is global, it wasn't widely accepted by other regulators. And so that's why we felt it was important to bring this as part of a topic for ICH to actually develop a guideline that could be accepted and broadly embraced by all the regulatory agencies So that was undertaken, I think, in 2017 or 2018. It was like a 5-year process working with the EMA, with Japan, with Health Canada, something around 30 people who were involved, the founders of ICH, the founding members of ICH, and also involving members from industry. And just really excited to announce when it was, I think, in 2022, when we actually got to the final stages of the ICH guideline development and got it published. That's where we then converted our 2016 guidance to the ICH E19 guidance and finalized that. So with that, we're hoping that there's actually going to be more uptake and application of E19 in all the global drug development programs.
And I think I noticed all the way from China and Japan through Canada, Europe, the US, E19 is now embraced in that final form.
Yes, I think that's called I think a step five of the ICH guideline development. So, each of the different, after we completed our ICH guideline and got to the final step, each of the different regions then actually adopted into their own form. So on the FDA side, we adopted by publishing a final FDA guidance.
Mary, I'll ask you a question. You've already kind of articulated some areas where SSDC could be applied, where we know the compound well as articulated. Are there other contexts or situations that you can expand on where you think SSDC is appropriate?
Well, I think the first part here is where the safety profile is well established is important. I don't think we can deviate around that. I think if you just look strictly at the guidance, particularly the title, it's in the late stage pre-approval and post-approval setting. The details really need to be fleshed out a little bit more, and you can actually go through the guidance on that. The guidance actually talk about areas where it's perhaps not in scope, and in particular bringing out gene therapy and in rare diseases, basically the vulnerable patient population. And the reason why in that setting there, when we had this work group that we wanted to say that it was not in scope, was because those are studies where, well, one, a novel type of intervention, so gene therapy, or in a setting where you have very limited patient population. So the likelihood that we, would know a lot about that drug in that setting is limited. So we can't really say that it's well characterized in that setting. I think the caveat, and we had this discussion, but we didn't think it was, really in scope to talk about it in detail in that guidance, is that there are conditions in the rare disease population where you are using therapies that have been approved elsewhere. And certainly in that situation, you can leverage the safety information that has already been established for that product, particularly if it was approved in a common disease. And so that you don't have to apply that or require comprehensive safety data collection when that drug that already established or that approved drug is being developed in the rare disease. And that's actually important. I recently participated in a workshop where we actually had somebody, I think she was from the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. And she really didn't realize that this was an area where you could apply, so like the safety data collection, if you have repurposed therapies. And it really is important, particularly in a rare disease setting where patients are traveling long distance to a clinical trial site. And the burden of having to collect a lot of information does actually really matter for a lot of these patients where you're limited in patients willing to be part of a program. And that burden may actually make it even more challenging to keep them and retain them in a clinical investigation. So that's one other area that, we certainly could talk about outside of the scope of that guideline or the guidance.
So, Mary, I mean, this seems to make sense on so many levels. You've mentioned drug repurposing, which I think we'll see more and more of. So that's fantastic. One of the things you'd mentioned, rare, I think there's a subject actually Craig is very passionate about. As we go towards perhaps programs being sponsored not by traditional biopharma, but patient groups and others, the more we can do to reduce the cost and obviously the patient burden better. So there's lots of layers to this of why it's a good idea. So I'm really glad we're talking about this. Thank you.
That's a great theme, to make a parking lot note around is around drug repurposing. And certainly that's applicable in many indications, but the rare disease community is certainly very enthusiastic there and often lacks the resources to run, the studies with the breadth of data collection that, pharma may be budgeted and resourced to support. And so drug repurposing sounds like a great use case for selective safety data collection.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So Mitch, I'm going to go to you next and try to get a little more in the weeds. In fact, I was involved with a program very much like what Dr. Kulally and Craig just described. Rare disease, very well characterized safety profile, but not in this patient population. In fact, millions of people had been treated with this drug by the time we were doing that. This guidance didn't exist then. So, if you were giving advice to, let's say, a program director who was going to undertake using SSDC, how would you advise them to get started? Do they have to create the list of what we're not going to pay attention to, or is there a whole different approach you would suggest?
So, thank you for the question. I'm going to reframe it a little bit into the overall purpose of SSDC. And this is to ensure that we're collecting data that is valuable. And if the decision-making in every case is a discussion between the involved parties, the investigators, the patients, of course, and the patient population, as well as the regulators. It is important to recognize that it's really the items that we agree there is already this basal understanding of that will not add value to the trial and will only really add burden are the things that we can agree maybe do not need to be collected. More broadly, it's important to recognize that SSDC is not a black or white decision. There are actually many shades of gray in terms of its implementation. Most fundamentally, at any point, the collection of safety data could switch from an SSDC framework to more comprehensive data collection if there was ever a safety signal that needed to be further investigated, or there was something unexpected that happened in a population of patients that was newly exposed in the clinical trial setting to an intervention. The closer in general that the population of for the clinical trial is to, say, the approved population if things are being repurposed, or the population of patients that have been previously exposed, the lower the concern generally will be that you will find a new safety signal that might merit more comprehensive data collection. But those are the issues that need to be considered. And so that fundamentally is what is known about the safety profile of the drug in general to be considering SSDC, it needs to be quite well understood. How close is the new population to the previously exposed population for which there is substantial data? And then how do you intend to apply it? You can, as I said, always switch from selective safety data collection to a more comprehensive. But in the implementation, you could, in fact, even start with a comprehensive safety data collection. And as you gain new information with a new population, you could then have pre-specified how you were going to move then subsequently to selective safety data collection. You could pre-specify that you're going to start comprehensive data collection only in a subset or selective safety data collection only in a subset of the population, and then move more broadly once you hit pre-specified target data collection or safety information that has been gathered. And then I think the most straightforward is if you just feel comfortable and everyone involved feels comfortable that there's sufficient safety data to initiate with selective safety data collection for everyone and proceed from there with appropriate guide rails in place. Remembering that there's going to be clinical data collection based on site investigators and trial personnel going on for all these patients. So there's always an opportunity to identify new concerns, and then switch course as the trial is ongoing.
Jane, you know what I love about Mitch's answer is, aside from the fact that, it describes that there's different pathways. It's not just either zero or one. There are hybrid approaches and other ways to be able to transition to that SSDC mindset. But I also love that perspective that it's not about detailing the data you're not collecting. It's about thinking about the data that you actually need. I don't know about you all, but I have Olympic fever this week, and there was a an interview with a freestyle skier this week. One of the reporters asked her, "Do you feel like you won two silver medals, or did you lose two gold medals?" And just how absurd, of course, that question is. But it kind of reminds me of that same mindset. Let's focus on the data we actually need, not on what data we thought maybe we needed, but we're not actually going to collect here.
I think the other element that I hear so clearly from you, Mitch, is that it's adaptive and fit for purpose. So the treatment emergent landscape is very much a part of how this gets implemented. And that makes total sense. It probably feeds into your next question, Craig.
Well, I'm just thinking about, incentives and Freakonomics and like, well, what's in it for me? And so if I'm a sponsor that's considering a program, where maybe, this is a molecule whose safety profile we have a good read on now, late phase trial, what are some of the, either incentives or maybe even myths around why I should or shouldn't consider SSDC for my program?
And this is, I think, the key is it really is individualized, as we were just talking about. I think the opportunity, as we all know, is the burden both to sites, sponsors, and to most importantly to patients in terms of data collection that may not be, as we said, of value to the clinical development framework. And so if you can streamline the clinical trial, you can enroll patients with lower burden of trial visits, of blood draws, which typically people don't really appreciate, and you can reduce costs for the overall program. You can more efficiently and perhaps more rapidly generate actionable data and evidence for the use of novel therapies or in novel populations. And thus, you can know how to better take care of patients, make them feel better, and function better and live longer. Which is the whole goal of all the programs. And I think it is in this way that everyone can be aligned. If the criteria for SSDC appear to be present, it can be win for everybody by implementation, which is of course the goal.
One kind of yes and on that, Mitch, and maybe this is a Mary question, I'm not sure, but I'm sure even during the E19 comment process, there were a lot of comments that you received from folks in industry. And I'm just curious, are there some prevailing like mythbusters that jump to your mind just based on the types of comments you might have received that maybe we can demystify a bit? Mary, were there any that jumped to your mind when you think about the comments received?
Surprised some of the comments that we received. I think the biggest one, can you hear me?
It's a little bit quiet.
You've
Yeah.
gone much more faint for some reason. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Not sure why. Can you hear
You're
me
good
now? I'm
now. You're good now.
okay.
Yeah.
It seems like I have to get a little closer. All right. So when we got the public comments, I have to say that some of them, we weren't surprised by the comments. We were actually more surprised by where they were coming from. Because we thought that, to get to step, I guess at that point was step two, that having been a part of ICH, that the objective of the whole work group was already conveyed to the different regions. And yet we still had some comments from member states where they were really concerned that we were lowering the standard with respect to ensuring safety in clinical drug development. And so we really did have to go back and make greater effort to say that no, that's not the case, actually have more details as to what are those factors that one would need to consider to get to the point of you have a well-characterized safety profile for this drug before you can move that. There was a lot of discussion that this is not a sort of a ad hoc decision. This was a prospectively planned decision in a protocol, a discussion that has to take place with the regulatory agencies to get them to agree to this. And at that point, there was a lot more reassurance. I think the other thing is that we cannot emphasize enough that safety monitoring is not eliminated with trials that implement SSDC. That responsibility is still a necessity for the clinical investigator, the study site personnel, the sponsor, even the regulatory authority, the agencies, is that that safety monitoring and actionable actions, necessary actions when something arises. I think Mitch touched on this, is that that's when you may have to pivot. You may have to pivot from SSDC to comprehensive, or definitely pivot for that one particular individual if there was a safety event that requires more intensive monitoring on.
So, Mary, I want to comment that I think as we all try and modernize clinical trials, we've gone from a mindset where I think, historically we've been scientists doing experiments, really. This isn't healthcare, right? We're doing an experiment, and as scientists, we like as much data as possible. And I think we're kind of moving to where understanding that, you got to be sensible about this. And frankly, from a sponsor perspective, Craig, you said, what's the incentive? I mean, any sensible sponsor should want their protocols to be both site and patient friendly, right? In a competitive environment, especially, right? That's for sure. But I think it seems to me we just have to kind of keep thinking the way Mary's framed it, where within the context of a very sensible proposal that really allows safety, how can we reduce the amount of data we collect? I think it's just a mindset we've had historically as scientists. And frankly, I think two of the problems at the sponsor side are many people writing protocols are scientists. They've never treated the patient. They've never worked at a site. So to them, just more data is good, right? So that's definitely been a problem. The other problem is the conservatism within the companies and the regulatory groups, where even when encouraged by regulators, there is kind of, you can't go wrong being conservative. So I think those are all factors that we have with anything, frankly, but I think maybe playing here too.
I'd like to double click there just for a minute, actually. And Diego has prompted an idea. I'm going to let him ask his own question in a little bit, but I'm really curious if you have any guidance or words of wisdom to actually help both the sites and sponsors over this change adoption curve. Because we are all trained to capture everything, write it all down, make sure it's all reported, et cetera. So, especially from the site point of view, do you have any suggestions about how we help them understand we're not actually diminishing our safety oversight, we're taking a different approach, or maybe you would say it very differently. And I would like Mitch to start, and then Mary, if you have anything to add, please do.
So again, I think that this is the crux of it, really, is having everyone buy into this opportunity in correct scenarios where this is applicable. And again, it is a little bit of a reframing. It is a reframing to doing this in a situation where all that extra data collection is not going to add to your understanding of benefit and risk. Where it's not going to change the understanding of safety and effectiveness that the intervention will provide. And so it is in a place where, as opposed to you are diminishing your collection of items, adverse events, and safety events that are going to be meaningful in your assessment. Or meaningful to patients, you are doing this only in a situation where the collection of adverse events that are not serious adverse events, that are not events that lead to discontinuation of therapy, that are not events that lead to serious morbidity or mortality, but other events that you already have an understanding of what they are. And thus, you are choosing to do this in a situation only where collection of that data is really not going to be meaningful and only cause burden. And so it is not an overall decrement in safety data collection or decrement in the safety for participants in your clinical trial, but where the only thing to be gained is burden and cost. And so I think that that is the framing switch that is really important to understand. And I think to answer in part the question that is in the chat, it is you are still collecting all of your meaningful serious adverse events and other events that I just described. What you are eliminating ideally is the collection of adverse events that you already have large amounts of data around and that are not going to change your thinking, either from a regulatory standpoint or honestly from a clinical standpoint in terms of how you might use that intervention.
So, might you actually hypothesize that the signal, the safety signal, gets clearer in this setting?
So there's, I think you want to collect the serious adverse event data and the other events that I described because you want to make sure that you understand that those are similar to what you know in wherever you have additional data for a potential intervention that you're investigating. From a purely evidence generation standpoint, yes, you're adding more data to your understanding of the therapy, and so your understanding of the safety signals will improve merely by adding more data. I think the little bit of the switch is saying that the potentially low value data that you would not collect as part of an SSDC approach just would not change dramatically or clinically meaningfully what you are assessing in terms of the risk benefit analysis of using that intervention.
Perfect. I am reliving all the maybe not so useful queries I sent to sites on grade one rash, you know.
Jane, can I just add to that?
Please.
Absolutely. Because I'm just looking in the chat and I'm seeing, to make sure that you don't miss a key safety signal. I think it's really important to ask ourselves, what do we mean by a safety signal or an adverse event? An adverse event can be a rash, it could be nausea, it can be a seizure, it can be serious thrombocytopenia. And so there are gradation on adverse events. I don't know of any drug development program where you're not going to see things such as non-serious adverse events, where some numbers look a little bit more on drug and less on placebo. But when you really dig into it, there hasn't been a reason for why a patient may be actually that's attributable to drug, or even if it's attributable, we can even talk about that. So really what this is about is focusing on those adverse events that are actually important. We have to remember that SSDC or E19 does not take away the requirements under the regulations in any regulatory agency. So on the FDA side of things, we would still require companies to collect serious adverse events. We would still require companies to collect information on adverse events that lead to study discontinuation, drug discontinuation. Adverse events that are associated with things such as hospitalization or pregnancy outcome, et cetera. So I think that that should be the other reassurance here, is that there are always a degree of requirement that we can't get around. But it's, as you point out, Jane, asking investigators and patients to even report on those we call them non-serious adverse events that have been already really well established and collected throughout drug development. You can go to the label and you can see it. It's not going to add any more. And I'll give you an example. I actually, I love going and giving these talks because you learn so much about what, we don't know and what others are struggling with. But one of the fears that came up was that, well, if we don't continue to collect this, what, how would we update table six, a table, the adverse event table in, section six of the label, which, is talking about the non-serious adverse events. And so the question then is, so if your non-serious adverse event is, let's say, a rash or nausea, so now you're going to find out that it's going from 0.6% to 0.8%. And in placebo, it doesn't change, or maybe it even goes down. But are you taking any regulatory action on this? And there's complete silence. And I think having those conversations really help provide people understand what we are talking about in terms of targeting safety data collection, targeting collection of information that's relevant. The other thing here is that adverse events of special interest, a company or the regulator, if they know that there is an adverse event that is important, that they even if it's labeled, but they still want to collect it, whether it be because they want to understand how that risk may be modified, may be different in a different indication, or because they feel that this is actually important as part of the safety monitoring. That is part of the protocol. That's why it's really important to have that protocol define what SSDC is and having that agreement with between the regulators and the company. The other thing I want to raise that I just recently learned a couple of months ago on another show on the road was that protocols, there are these templates that companies and CROs will use. And that's great from an efficiency standpoint. What may happen here is that the efficiency doesn't actually then lead to somebody stepping back and saying, huh, do I need to continue to check the box that, these patients need to come in and have their complete chemistry profile, urinalysis, EKG, chest X-ray, et cetera. It's in the template. As opposed to saying, this is the drug that we have that we've now gotten approved on three different indications across a broad spectrum of patient population. Do we still need to have all that? And have that internal discussion within the company and then take that to the regulators and explain we're actually deviating from this, and this is the reason why. I think all too often it's probably easy to use that template protocol and not ask that question.
So I think, Mary, you're actually being very generous saying that perhaps the AE rate or a rash might go up a bit. My understanding here is when you're dealing in the context of this, you have such a volume of other studies. There's highly unlikely that one study, frankly, would even change at point one. It could, as you said, doesn't matter. But I think you're being generous, even thinking that, those people thinking they're going to even change that table. Because in all likelihood, considering how much data you already collected, it's probably not going to change that. Not that it matters, even if it did, like you said. But so that's one thing. I mean, the analogy I'll take is, people, I think all of us in drug development have to realize we're in the bigger context of participants' experience. So, all of big tech, all they do all day is try and what they will call reduce friction, right? They don't want any. Now, sometimes friction is good, but they don't like friction, right? And I think I see this as reducing some of the useless friction that prevents people getting into trials or people affording the trial. And it's so sensible to do that, right? If, as I think Mitch has articulated that very well. And I think to me, we have to understand that, we just can't keep imposing on sponsors, sites, and patients. And I really love the fact that, regulators always show they're trying to make it better. So I really appreciate that. I do want to ask Magano a question, though, from C3TI perspective. Why did you choose to prioritize SSDC and have it as a demonstration project?
Sure. Thanks so much, Amir. So, I mean, I think we've heard loud and clear from Mary, from Mitch, and even from, from you all as you're asking your questions and sharing your experiences, that there's clear benefits here, right? For sponsors, for investigators, and most importantly, for study participants. And so it was really a natural fit for C3TI. C3TI, we're looking to promote the broader adoption of approaches that improve the efficiencies in drug development. So this fit nicely. And then we also recognize that, SSDC is at the right stage for implementation and scalability. We had the ICH guideline. We heard that it's, at step five. We're seeing global regulators adopt this. We have some experience under our belt, and we're really at a point where we need to gain more experience, right, in the implementation in the real world settings and scale this across drug development programs across therapeutic areas. And so that's why the demonstration project that we have at C3TI fits nicely here. It's an opportunity to kind of promote the principles of SSDC. It gives a mechanism for early engagement, right, between sponsors and our CDER experts. One of you all mentioned earlier that there might be residents, like kind of like a perceived, risk aversion here, right, amongst sponsors and so forth, right? And one of the ways that we as the agency can kind of help address that is offer to engage early with our folks and meet with sponsors. And so with our demonstration program, it's the review team, but it's also experts like Mary and Mitch who've been thinking about SSDC a lot, right? Kind of bringing all of that expertise to the table and working closely with the sponsors and guiding them as they're designing and implementing trials that incorporate SSDC. And this could also include facilitating discussions with international regulators, right? If needed for some of these multi-regional trials. So we really encourage, folks who might have a development program where you think SSDC might be a good fit to think about the demonstration program. We review proposals on an ongoing basis, and we have an actually a pretty user-friendly URL actually as well. It's fda.gov/C3TI. So that's as good as it's going to get from us on that front. And then I also just wanted to look at Diego's question in the chat about examples. I mean, that's the other thing that we really heard, right, from folks. And really to do that broader adoption, we need to share the lessons learned, our experiences, and so forth, right? And that's why we published the white paper. As we're waiting for trials to kind of come in through the demonstration program, we also wanted to start sharing the experience that we did already have, right? So if you haven't taken a look at the white paper, please do so because we talk about several trials in oncology and in the cardiometabolic spaces that have incorporated SSDC. And there are some tables in there that just really black and white. Like it is black and white, like what you're collecting, what you're not collecting. And it's very easy to see those benefits that Mitch and Mary and we've all been talking about, like how much time is saved, how many trips, how many lab visits. And you can easily probably, put it into AI and ask it, how much money did this probably save? And it would probably be, something to generate as well. And so, really, what we're looking with the demonstration program, with the white paper, and all of C3TI is to build that shared knowledge around SSDC, improve understanding around how to apply it in the real world setting, identify potential challenges and then solutions for that, and then promote the best practices. So, Craig kind of teed it up at the very beginning. Now you're thinking about SSDC, but if you want to engage with the agency, how do you do that? C3TI is a great entry point for that.
Right, thank you.
Meghana, while you're mentioning C3TI and sort of that door, what are the other demonstration projects that the group is prioritizing right now?
Sure, thanks, Craig. So one other area is Bayesian statistics. Once again, it's not a new methodology or new approach. It's been around for many, many years. But just kind of really thinking about using it in the drug development programs, either as kind of your primary analysis or as a supplemental analysis. And it's pretty timely now because we recently issued draft guidance on Bayesian methodology in this space. So that's another opportunity if you're thinking about it, come talk to us and you can kind of get that extra expertise, right? The folks internally that have been that have expertise in that area, working with the review teams and the sponsors to kind of think about that. And then a third area is what we've coined the Streamlined Trials and Embedded in Clinical Practice, or STEP. This is, for example, point of care trials or trials that are leveraging other pragmatic elements such as digital health technologies or decentralized features. That'll probably resonate with you and your audience a lot, and so forth. And so that's another area that we have that we have in our demonstration program.
And when folks are engaging through the demonstration projects, let's say with SSDC, are the reviewers for that submission kind of embedded with you then so that we can remove some of the fear or perception that the demonstration project folks believe in something, but will my reviewer ultimately support this strategy for my submission?
Sure. So I have a lot of comments on that. One, I think it's important to notice that we have three folks from Office of New Drugs or OND on this call, including two reviewers, right? So I would almost say it's the other way around, right? So it comes in to the review team, and then we may embed some C3 to expertise into the review team and give them that. So it's very much run by the review teams because you're right, Craig, we did hear some feedback early on as we were establishing C3TI that sometimes we might have some pilot projects or demonstration projects at the agency, and they get certain feedback and certain, guidance and so forth. But then by the time it gets to the review team, there's a difference of opinion, and so forth. So that's why really when we were designing this, we start with the review team, and then the C3TI expertise is kind of augmented on top of that. But we worked it from day one with the review team. And they are the ones that are actually reviewing first the proposals that come in, whether it would be a good fit for the demonstration program and provide us their recommendation,
That's
actually.
great. That's a great takeaway for folks. This is really innovation being driven by those review teams and those review functions, supported by and amplified by C3TI, not pushed down onto the reviewers by some other external innovation force or function. That's a great distinction. Hey, if there are questions, this is the joy of being able to join us live for those of you that are here with us live. If you have questions, please use that hand-raising icon there and we will pull you up, just like we're going to do now with our friend Diego Martinez. Diego, I see your hand raised there. If you don't mind coming off mute, introduce yourself for folks that haven't had the pleasure. Let us know what's on your mind.
Hi everyone, Diego Martinez here with PARXL. I'm with the Decentralized Clinical Trial Solution team. Thank you for the opportunity. I think this is a great conversation. And I wanted to drill down a little bit more into my question because I really like always figuring out the operations components. I wanna propose a very simple example. Let's say I'm a monitor CRA training my site on a new study that is going to be implemented selected safety data reporting, right? So by design, that is going to be written into the protocol, but my site might ask me, what are the expectations with the documentation around adverse events? Common practice for sites, they have developed AE logs that emulate, mirror basically the CRF design. Because why? It is too much to ask a busy doctor to remember in the narrative of a progress note to document every single element that is associated with an adverse event. So sites have implemented logs. Now, if I need to tell them, you are going to be only transcribing key safety data, adverse events of interest, but what would it be my recommendation to the site when it comes to documenting, source documenting every single adverse event with all the attributions that they need, relationship, grading, action taken, and outcome. So what is your point? What is your point on that? What would you recommend? Because in my view, they will still do business as usual and document everything. But the differentiator here is when they move that data from the source onto the EDC. Now, the EDCs, I understand, are going to be designed to only collect the selective safety data.
Thanks so much, Diego, for the question. And some of the answer may be that's the beauty of doing these as demonstration projects so that folks from study teams, their CRO partners, the regulators can dig in the weeds around some of these nuances of where data may be captured at the site versus what ultimately is transcribed and where and how, so that those can turn into best practices that can be shared or further amplified. Mitch, Mary, I don't know if you have any other thoughts right now, at least around what Diego is pointing out for how maybe a site is capturing data in a way to try to simplify and normalize things across their different studies.
I can start off, and Mitch is much closer to this than I am.
Mary, we're back to having you very faint again.
All right. Can you hear me now? No? Oh my goodness. All right, Mitch, you take it.
Oh, there
That's
you started to get
better.
improved there, but it's almost like your
Okay.
microphone's warming up each time.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that. I'm not sure. I didn't do anything when I joined Zoom, so I'm not sure what happened. So I'll start up, but Mitch is much closer to this than I am. So Diego, one of the things that we've heard with respect to data collection, recording of data, and submitting of data, but particularly recording of the data, and getting it from your source documents, is what happens when the site gets inspected. And I think this is why I had alluded to this, that when E19 was finalized, it wasn't just a matter of socializing this with the outside world, it was socializing it internally. Because it's not just the review divisions that Meghna was talking about who actually look at something and think that SSDC is appropriate. It's actually also speaking with that organization, that unit within the agency that is the site inspectors, so that they know, that this is what's in the protocol. These are the reasons why something is or may not be collected, because it's a retraining for a lot of staff on this as well. So that's one thing. I think the other thing here, and I may be misunderstanding your question here, is that what information is going to be transmitted? There is something to say about transmitting, collecting information, and reporting information, sending it in to a regulatory agency. The more information that we receive that is not necessary to make that benefit risk decision is the more data we have to dig through to get to that important benefit risk decision. And ironically, the more we have to dig through, we may end up actually missing that important thing. So that's why when we think through prospectively about the protocol and what should be collected and what should actually be submitted, that think about that as the end goal for on the regulatory side. It's not only a reduced burden for perhaps many players, but it increases the ability to actually find that signal of importance. It's sort of like taking away a lot of the noise so that you can actually get to finding that needle in the haystack. Hopefully, it's not there for many products, but that's what the goal is.
So, Mary, Diego, if I can translate your question, I'll give you my interpretation of it. Tell me if I'm wrong. What I heard Diego maybe say is that the workflow at the site level is that for the busy clinicians, it's easier for them to do business as usual and continue doing the same as every other study than to change for one particular study. The example I'll give you in my world of neuroscience is every sponsor wanted people to do an outcome measure the way they wanted it done. And yet they were seeing different patients every day. And it was very unrealistic to think they were going to do that differently for different patients. So Diego, is that what you were saying, that it's easier for the clinicians just to collect as they're used to it, but then they just wouldn't put it in DC for that particular study? Am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah, it's in those lines, right? Because again, these doctors are dealing with multiple different studies. And if they, at the time of documenting, this is also a collaborative work with the coordinators, right? Coordinators play a tremendous role in the orchestration of the data, right? So it's going to be for this study, I'm not going to be documenting any hematological abnormalities on this one, chemistry or whatever it is. The way I really think this being adopted is the sites are going to continue with their workflows. They are going to, anything that looks like abnormal by the traditional definition of an adverse event is going to get documented in the source. But then, as I said before, the differentiator is by protocol design and the data collection tools, only certain key components of that really large adverse event log is going to be transcribed onto EDC and eventually analyzed. I see that the way being implemented at the site level, right?
Well, that's a real interesting real-world perspective, isn't it?
If I can comment, I think that in implementation of SSDC, which is, a component of creating a clinical trial environment that is more pragmatic. We have seen a variety of different details in terms of the implementation. And so we have seen, and again, as Mary described, right, the goal here is that at least from a regulatory standpoint, you're getting alignment based on all of the regulators and potential site evaluators that these are data that are not going to be needed unless there is an event that switches the trial to be more comprehensive. And so we have seen studies in which the site coordinators, as you mentioned, it's the research coordinators doing this work, not usually the clinicians, in which the research coordinators are not collecting those basic AE data because that's where the much of the savings and time and improved patient experience come from. The reporting from the site to the EDC is actually usually not the bulk of a lot of the other inefficiencies and costs necessarily. And so we have seen people implement this in a variety of ways. As was kind of touched on earlier, right? A lot of this just depends on sponsor and investigator uncertainty and uncertainty in the process, the complexity of, as you mentioned, implementing this process if it's distinct from other processes going on at the site, and uncertainty around the safety of their intervention, that it's truly going to work similar and they're not going to have to answer some other question afterwards. But I think if all those all of the necessities for SSDC are present, it is possible to create an environment where the site and the site investigators and the research coordinators actually do not need to collect some of that data.
We're
Thank you.
approaching the top of the hour here, and so I want to be mindful of everyone's time as we wrap up this week's installment of TGIF DTRA. I do want to give a shout out here and acknowledge, though, that the FDA did their part when they put out their guidance years ago around selective safety data collection, but they also heard and recognized some of the barriers to adoption. As Mary pointed out, went through a multi-year effort to normalize that through ICH, installed C3TI as a big shiny door for innovative companies to knock on to be able to engage and use these types of approaches. Now, this falls on the community, this ecosystem, all of you who are listening, your companies, to be able to bring this information back and to make sure that for molecules.